Are you on the record?
Good morning. I'd like to call the Beta Wednesday, May 15th board meeting to order. And I'm ready to do a roll call with board members.
Commissioner Sandy? Commissioner Crum?
Present.
Here.
Mr. Ellis?
Here.
Mr. Kendig?
Here.
Mr. Beaglemore?
Here.
Chair Cruz?
Here.
You have a quorum, sir.
Thank you. Before us is an agenda for today. That's the board members that take a look at it. And I'll entertain a motion.
This is Bill Kendig. I move to approve the agenda as presented.
This is Albert. I'll second.
Thank you for the discussion. I will note that Commissioner Sandy is back online. Hearing no further discussion, is there any objection to adopting the agenda as we see it today? Hearing none, the agenda is approved. Bring this item number four, prior minutes, March 6, 2024.
This is Bill Kendig. I move the prior minutes, March 6, 2024, as presented.
This is Albert. I'll second.
Discussion? Corrections, deletions, additions? Any objections to adopting the minutes as presented? Seeing none, those minutes are adopted for March 6th. Brings us to item number five, public comments. I would ask people who are wishing to make a comment, please state your name and affiliation if you have one clearly for our record. And 2 minutes per person. Amy, is there anybody online?
If there are any members on the line that wish to make a public comment, please press star 9 on your phone now. You will be recognized in the order that you are called. Please clearly state your name and affiliation if you have one. Chair, there are no members on the line.
Is there anybody in the boardroom wishing to make a public comment? Seeing none, I will close the public comment section. That brings us up to item number six, board training, annual ethics, confidentiality, and conflict of interest. Randy, where are we going with that?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stinson from the Attorney General's office is here to walk through the presentation with the board.
All right. What's your name again?
My name is Matthew Stinson.
I go by Matt?
Yeah, I usually go by Matt, but
we're gonna
not the kind of kid.
We're going to call you Matt unless we're excited. We'll call you Matthew.
Sounds good, yeah. If you think I'm straying outside the bounds, just
Matthew. You're Matthew. Yeah. Well, welcome, Matthew. I appreciate you helping us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. So I'm a little bit conscious of trying to keep things on time. Ordinarily, when I do these presentations, I encourage questions as we go, but I think it's probably better just to write down questions if they come up, and then we'll see at the end if we've got a good time to answer it. If you have a burning question, you can ask it as we go, too, but I think it'll just be a better way to kind of keep a handle on the clock a little bit.
If it's all right, I kind of look at this as a recurrent training, not initial. So, so for those board members that have questions.
Yeah, and this is only one part of the conversation. I can be reached by phone and email with questions, concerns as they come up. So.
All right. Thank you. Julie and Anna, can you see everything on the site, on your website, on your computer?
Yes, we can see everything.
All right.
So the Ethics Act applies to people who qualify as public officers. Public officers include public employees for the state, but also members of board and commissions are within the definition of public officers. So people gathered here today. Move on to the next one. So under the Ethics Act, there's a lot of different causes.
Yeah. Hold on for a minute. Randy, can you see for a minute? Thank you, Matt. Go ahead.
So under the Ethics Act, there's different serious causes of actions or potential violations that come up. The biggest category of them is misuse of official position, and there's a lot of different ones that fit within that broader category. Move on to the next slide. So how does one misuse official position? Some of the things that come up most often would be somebody using their position for personal gain or to give unwarranted benefit or treatment to another person. An example of this could be hiring a person who is unqualified or otherwise giving a different treatment or a different process to one person as a leg up as opposed to the general hiring practices. But the other things that come up a lot, can't use your position to secure other employment or contracts. So, I scratch your back now, you scratch my back later, that kind of behavior is not going to be acceptable under the Ethics Act. Similarly, you can't use your position, your official status, in order to solicit outside compensation for the same work that you're already doing for the state. So the shorthand for that is no tips for doing your job. Move on to the next slide. So misuse of official position, basically you can't use state resources to benefit a personal or financial interest. The idea is that if you're working on behalf of the state, you don't want to be on both sides of a transaction where you're doing state work that's also benefiting yourself in a private capacity, either financially or through some kind of membership benefit advancement of some kind. And under AS 3952-120B4, you can't take or withhold official action on matters in which you have a personal or financial interest. So that's already something that's going to trigger further review. If you're looking at a situation and then you're saying, okay, there is a potential interest that's at stake and what I'm doing could affect that interest, that goes into the next question. Is the interest a substantial one? Because the Ethics Act is concerned primarily about substantial material conflicts of interest. So, for example, if you have an interest, like you have less than $5,000 worth of ownership in a company, you're doing official action that's going to affect that company. Generally speaking, that's going to be considered insignificant. There's a statutory presumption. It gets a little bit different in terms of if you're an agency awarding contracts, then that kind of triggers another section. But at least under misuse of official position, less than $5,000 stake in a business, that's going to be considered insignificant as a presumption. And then also if you have an interest that's possessed generally by the public at large, this is pretty rare. The clearest example would be the PFD. If you're doing some kind of action interacting with the PFD, basically every Alaskan receives the PFD. No one's going to think that you're trying to, move the lever to get your PFD check a little bit bigger. And the other category is, let's say that there is a significant interest. Just because it's beyond $5,000 doesn't make it a significant interest, but let's say that it's a very substantial amount of money at stake. The next question would be, would your action have an insignificant or conjectural effect on the matter, or would your action have a significant effect? So insignificant would be, if you look at it just in dollars and cents, maybe you have a very high percentage of money involved in something or an immediate family member, but the actual action that you take as a public officer has such a small impact on that, then you're going to look at that, we'll look at that as an assessment and say, okay, so the impact is insignificant. That's not really going to be a concern under the Ethics Act. The other thing that comes up is the effect conjectural. So you can think of conjectural also as like speculative. So if I take action A, B could happen, C could happen, D could happen, and then oh no, E would be bad. The more attenuated it is, the more spread out it is, the more it's like a subject of guesswork as if the effect is even going to happen, the more likely that it's going to be seen as just a conjectural effect and not the kind of thing that's prohibited by the Ethics Act. So Ethics Act is concerned with substantial material conflicts of interest. You can go to the next one. And it's important to know that when we're talking about your interests, that includes your immediate family members. The interest is basically treated the same under the Ethics Act. So if it's somebody who fits within that category, like a spouse or a parent or a sibling, and they're the CEO of some such company, and then they're going to benefit significantly from some action, it's going to be imputed to you or treated as your interest because of the immediate family member status. And then covered the unwarranted benefit or treatment for others that's not limited by the immediate family member category. That's just a broader analysis on is somebody being treated, you know, given a leg up because of, you know, if they're a friend or something like that.
So Matt,
yeah.
Just for a clarification, if there's a potential of a financial gain, i.e., like for instance, in my world, I'm a contractor and I bid on work and propose on work.
Mm-hmm.
So as a board member of whether it's ADA or some other, and that's going to put work out on the street that I potentially may bid on or propose on, how does that affect? How does that affect the board member and the conflict?
So there's two different statutes that each need to be analyzed in those situations. So one of them is misuse of official position, like what we're talking about, and that runs through the same kind of analysis that we've been talking about, the sort of, is it a substantial interest, how direct is the effect?
But there's no interest yet, but you know, if it goes on the street, you know, through the public procurement process, and my company decides to price it or bid it, you know, typically they're hard dollar, low bids, sometimes subjective analysis, not often, but we may have board members that do proposals that there may not be successful. What I'd like to know is, do we say a potential conflict? Do we say it is a conflict and I can't vote on it? I mean, obviously it's for the benefit of the good for the public, but there is a potential, or, you know, we'll call it the, you know, it's the Energy Authority Board, and they're gonna go out for a solicitation for generators, and I represent John Deere generators. That, you know, that may or not be a John Deere generator, maybe a Caterpillar, maybe a Cummins diesel generator, who knows, but I know that I may propose on that, because see, what do we do there?
So that comes up more under AS 3952-150, which is, I've got some slides on that later on, but it becomes a question of whether or not you are part of the agency, or, you know, that's awarding, administering the, you know, the contract or the loan or, you know, what have you. And it's actually a very strict kind of part of the Ethics Act and can be pretty prohibitive. There's also a specific statute for ADA that is in addition to the Ethics Act. It's not replaced by the Ethics Act. And that talks about having an interest in a contract that's before them. So those things end up being pretty restricted, but it's also, I need to know, you know, the details of the particular circumstance to see whether or not the member in question is part of the, you know, unit, the administrative unit awarding the grant. And so.
Well, okay. But let's say it's a procurement where it's hard dollar. So it's out to the public, and anybody can bid on it, including myself. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I mean, the decision hasn't been made whether or not that I or the company would bid on it. Until you see the solicitation by the organization, whether it's ADA or AA, until you see what it says and what the requirements are, you can't make that decision whether or not you're going to bid on it. But at the board level, we're making a decision to actually, you know, put the project out, you know, authorizing the project for staff, and, you know, for Randy to build, you know, to fund a road or something, whether or not I would propose on that road or bid a portion of the road or be even a subcontractor on the road. I just want to make sure I understand. To me, that's where I don't know where to declare the conflict or not, because, one, I don't know what the solicitation is going to say. It's going to say, you know, Randy, the staff is authorized to build a road. All right, and they're going to go finance it or whatever. That's where the board is. How they do it, or what methodology they use, and how they break it up into parts and pieces, and who does what and where, that's a whole different story. Does that make sense?
I understand what you're asking, and there's provisions under AS 3952-150 that talk about, you know, competitively solicited grants and things like that. But the strict concerns.
We don't do grants. ADA doesn't do grants.
I'm kind of, it says, you know, grants, loans, leases, and so it's like a longer running, I'm kind of just abbreviating it.
Okay. Well, It would be like a DOT project, a bidding a road for DOT, except DOT isn't the owner, ADA would be the owner.
So the question is, at some point, is the board going to be approving or denying it?
The
public officer, because the Ethics Act is it's individual. Is the public officer going to be somebody who is going to either is going to be voting on approving that or not? Like at some point. The award.
Well, the award is through the procurement process. We have no, we're not involved with that. The procurement process, it has a procurement process that's completely separate from the board. The authorizing going out to spend the money to build it for them to go out and put the procurement out, that's what we do. Once it goes out, we don't see it. We don't pass a resolution saying, you know, Bill Villamore and his company gets to build the road. It's, we tell Randy, go build, you know, you have your authorization to spend up to your budget, whatever millions of dollars, to solicit contractors to build a road. I mean, she's kind of an example.
So, it depends, looking at the Ethics Act, whether or not the public officer is in the position where they're part of the administrative unit that is awarding or administrating the grant, the contract, the lease, the loan.
Some kind of thing.
Yeah.
The board goes to, yeah, you can go award the contract. The board's done it for that. So after that, after the board's already said, yeah, you can go spend that money.
We don't know who it's to.
Can any board member bid on that project? That's the question.
If the board member is bidding on the project and then at some point it's coming back before the board.
If it's coming back to the board.
Yeah, then that's going to be a problem. If the board is saying generally we're going to make funds available for this kind of thing, and then people are going to, you know, try to get that contract, try to be involved in that. At that step saying that funds are going to be available for this kind of thing, that's not yet a violation, but it's if it comes back before the board and the board's making decisions about this, then
if it doesn't come back to the board,
more specifically, if it doesn't come back to the board, that board member can bid on that contract. That's the question.
It really depends. I don't know how much you guys really want the off-the-cuff answer versus the answer where I'm able to look at the definitions and work through it normally. I'm going to have to say that it depends. Requests for advisory opinions can be made, and confidential advisory opinions can be made. I'm not an expert on what the board does. The advice depends upon all the material facts being administered to us, in which case that we can give advice, and then if advice is complied by the officer, then, you know, the officer has some coverage there in terms of an advisory opinion. And I get requests for those through Randy or through Ken pretty regularly. So,
Mr. Chair, real quick, Matt, it may be helpful if you can look through your existing library of opinions for something close to this topic.
A very good one. I printed off a copy here that I think what has to do with this a bit, but if you can, it's published, it's online, it's a 1996 opinion, so requested advice, it's a Wilson Hughes 1996 Alaska opinion from the Attorney General's Office, and it published September 6, 1996. So it can be found online, but it talks a lot about, so AEA has a conflict of interest statute, ADA has a conflict of interest statute that is specific, and those things are layered on top of the Ethics Act. They're not replaced by the Ethics Act or supplant the Ethics Act, and this opinion goes into the definition of why. So it does make some of these questions a little bit complicated and kind of depends on the situation. So.
Well, the problem is that we as board members sit here, may or may not take a look at solicitation to participate in it when we make the decision.
I would seek advice from our office before taking steps to make the decision.
I can't tell you what a board member would do until the actual procurement came out and you saw the details of what the procurement is, and the requirements of the procurement, of schedule, bonding requirements, you know, no one would know. I mean, it's a construction, but it could be supplies, it could be a whole bunch of different things. Until you actually see what staff goes out on the street, the challenge is a board member would never know whether or not they would even be interested in proposing or bidding hard dollar billion. And so if that was that, does that make sense?
Yeah, I would recommend if someone's considering on making a bid for something, just to reach out for advice, and then you can get tailored advice to your situation that assesses all the material facts there. Because the question isn't so much, the facts matter, but it's applying the facts to the law, and the law has some places where there's flexibility about substantial material conflict of interest, but then there's some places where it's very strict. So when you're getting into the AS 3952-150 area, it becomes a lot more strict and interacts with the other specific conflict statutes for ADA. So it would just be a good idea to reach out for advice. And
all right, John, how about second-tier subs?
I mean,
Amber Road, okay? A couple big generals are building it, big generals. And they go and they solicit pricing for specific subcontractors. Whether it's build bridges, do crushing, camps, provide camps, you know, all the stuff to support the general contractor. If a subcontractor board member that may get solicited, they may not, you wouldn't know if a general is going to solicit you or even consider you, would that be a conflict? And that's way after the fact. Now the general contractor is dealing with ADA, we'll call it. The subcontractor, there's no contractual relationship between the subcontractor and the owner, ADA. There's a contractual relationship between the subcontractor and the general contractor.
So the question would be, how is your official action interacting with your personal or financial interests? Which is why it ends up being pretty context specific.
So
it's not so much just...
Well, it's something that's got to be resolved because we have some big projects going on, and people need to know how to do it. But there's no, you know, there should be a general boilerplate, what I would call, and this is why I want to have a conversation on ethics training, because we're going down the path of some very, very big projects that thousands of construction workers. I'm in the business. I want to know exactly what the rules are. Theoretical rules, even though I may or may not do any work on it. Right? Now, for sure, I won't know. I know I'll be a general contractor. I know that for sure. But I may be a sub to a sub. Hello, I don't. So that's kind of the issue. And you don't know until you see the solicitation and what's going on, huh?
You don't know.
Okay, we'll move on. Go ahead.
I do think, Chair, based on the conversations today, Matt, I could frame up a session 240 request.
That would be helpful.
Yeah.
I could get it over to you, and then you can respond and chair the, if you follow those guidelines, it provides absolute immunity for any actions taken. So we can work on that.
Disclosure that, right. You know, before the vote or whatever, you know.
Right.
A conversation about it. So, okay.
So, personal interest. Financial interest is pretty clear. Money's on the line. Personal interest, people don't always think of. So it's good to know that it includes membership in any organization. So it could even be a charitable organization or a political organization. And if you're taking official action that is creating a benefit for that organization that you're a part of, membership's pretty broad, then that would also be considered taking official action affecting personal interests. Go on the next slide.
So let me give you an example. I'm a I'm a I'm not an executive board member anymore. I used to be president of the organization, but I'm a board member for Associated General Contractors. 600 companies in the state. Okay? The who's who has to do anything with construction, from bonding companies to suppliers to subcontractors to general contractors to affiliates, insurance companies, the whole bit. So a project comes out, okay, and I'm a board member of an organization that was started in 1947 up here. Someone from that, one of those 600 companies for sure, I guarantee will be part of the project. Now, I don't have any financial interest in it, but I'm a life board member. I can't unlife myself. In other words, I'm not affiliated with any of the e-board runs the day-to-day business of the executive director. It would be e-board would be someone like us with Randy. Then there's the general board of directors, and then you serve so many, get elected so many years, and become a life board member. You never lose that life board membership. But every construction project in this state, to a T, will have an AGC member working on it in some fashion. You just can't. Huh? You can't, no. So, my question is, what does that mean to me?
We would look at whether or not it's a substantial material conflict of interest. There's three categories of things that would maybe not be substantial, right? Is the impact insignificant? Is the impact conjectural? Is it a large enough class of persons that no one's going to look at the circumstances and think that this is really what's influencing your actions? Those would all be things that we would look at. So.
All right. Come on. I'm going to be the excommunicator.
The questions are good. Can be reached outside of this. I'm not sure how much
maybe it'd help if we had a better definition of what an arm's length transaction would be on all of these.
So, we're seeking to apply the Ethics Act statutes as they exist and our regulations as they exist. And we've got kind of a back catalog of other advice that we've given. A lot of it is available publicly, but, you know, we do our best to apply it and interpret it consistently. But it's everything has, within the definitions in the Ethics Act, there's so much context room that's baked into it that it does make applying it in a boilerplate kind of way kind of difficult, unless you were to say that, you know, to cut out all kinds of things without weighing really are they that substantial. So there's a lot of individual attention that goes to it, and it's designed that way. Immediate family members got a specific definition. We were talking about that before. The interests are treated the same for you as a public officer. So that would be spouse, cohabitating conjugal partner, children, stepchildren, parents, siblings, grandparents, aunts, uncles, parents, some parents-in-law, brother and sister-in-law. So seems like it covers everything. Weirdly enough, the statute mentions the aunts and uncles, but not nieces and nephews. So we wouldn't count those as immediate family members. We apply the statute. But you also don't want to be.
It's not a family anymore. I like it.
Yeah, but then you still need to be careful about doing unwarranted benefit or treatment. So you still have to treat everybody the same. That could apply to anybody. But the big, you know, moral focus is on your individual interest and immediate family member interest. Supplying them. So. Yeah. It's the stuff that's listed in the statute all gets treated as the same as your interest. So it is both very broad, but doesn't cover everything.
It doesn't cover an uncle or aunt's sibling.
Exactly. Official action. So this just comes up a lot in the definition of what we're talking about. But the very simple way of looking at it, it's the things that you do through your position as a public officer. So it's a pretty broad definition, pretty easily met in most situations. We talked about this. So the Ethics Act doesn't expect that people are going to be just islands, you know, pulled from society, particularly in a small state like Alaska. Like, people are going to have variations of potential conflicts of interest, but minor inconsequential conflicts are not the concern, the concerns on substantial material conflicts. And the statutory presumption for 5,000 and lower is insignificant. Doesn't mean that what's beyond 5,000 is necessarily significant. It depends on the situation. We can skip this argument in the PSD one. And we can skip this too. We got into that. So gifts, you can't accept or solicit a gift if the gift is intended to influence your action or judgment in your official duties. So that's the ultimate question: would a reasonable person infer that it's affecting your decisions as a public officer? And the definition for gifts is pretty broad. It applies to most things. It does apply to travel and entertainment, but when it comes to the travel questions, we have regulations about that where a gift of travel is treated more as a gift to the state than to the individual. If it's, you know, particularly people going out to the bush on state business, sharing charter planes or things like that, that's when it comes up a lot. So we have specific rules for travel, but technically all those things are counted as a gift to people. So. Gifts from lobbyists are presumed improper. We've got some prior published opinions that have narrowed that a little bit in situations where somebody is like a close family friend or family member, and you guys always got each other birthday gifts, Christmas gifts, etc., for each other's family. And then lo and behold, that person becomes a lobbyist and you become a public officer. The scope of the relationship gets looked at to say, okay, is this somebody trying to influence somebody's action by buying this Christmas present, or are they just friends? So that's kind of a narrow exception there. So what are the gifts that have to be declared? A gift that's worth more than $150 that's to you or an immediate family member, that has to be reported. If you could take official action that would affect the gift giver, or if the gift is being given because of your position as a public officer. So if it's above 150 in either of those two, then those are the things that need to be disclosed. And if there's a situation comes up and it's one where somebody could reasonably infer, even if it's below $150, it's intended to influence your actions or judgment, when in doubt, just disclose or seek out ethics advice, because that's the ultimate question there. And then gifts from foreign governments, including tribal governments and city governments, those need to be declared and disclosed to the governor's office, and then they determine what to do with them. And, yeah, gift to immediate family members, a gift to you. So rules on information, this applies to current or former public officers. So even after you leave state service, you are prohibited from using non-public information for your benefit, or from using information confidential by law. Confidential by law is more clear. That's like attorney-client privilege or deliberative process privilege or documents that say confidential stamped on them and so on. Stuff that's been publicly disseminated, we've got a regulation on that. So if information's been put out into the public in newspaper broadcasts, you know, TV, court testimony that wasn't sealed, you know, things like that, all the things that are listed under that regulation, those are all considered publicly disseminated. So let's say you leave state service and, you know, you're an expert witness and you're giving analysis of, you know, some kind of action that the state did. It's after the two-year restriction that might get in the way of that. And you're only using stuff that's already out in the public to inform your analysis. Those things are going to be okay. But if you're doing things like submitting Freedom of Information Act requests, because you know certain stuff exists, because of your, you know, confidential information that you have as an officer, and you're trying to make it public, that workaround doesn't work in terms of the regulation. So, okay. Post-state employment, the biggest restriction is, that applies to most people, is a two-year restriction on working on a matter for compensation in which you participated personally and substantially through official action. This is interpreted narrowly, and all of the bolded words are necessary components. So they all run together, or the two-year restriction doesn't apply. You can go to the next slide.
I don't think 2 years apply to board members. 1 year.
So there's a specific one-year rule for board members about participating in the rule. That's in addition to the ordinary two-year rule.
Okay.
So the, and the two-year rule would be if you're working on a matter, so there was like, you know, a proposal before you guys, and you worked on that matter personally and substantially, you gave advice, you assessed it, so on. And then you leave the board, and then you are working privately for that same thing or in that same matter, and that's the kind of thing that's going to come up under the two-year restriction and stuff like that. So, matter's pretty broad. Just keep that in mind. It's like a thing, like a unit that you worked on. And if what the work that you did was like routine processing of documents, general supervision of employees without being directly involved in the matter, then that would be something that, per a regulation, that's not personal and substantial. So the more zoomed out you are, the less likely it's personal and substantial. The more involved you are, the more likely it is, and it's case-by-case basis. Official action, we talked about that one as easily met. And so there's some exceptions to the normal two-year rule. You can contract with the former agency, so the state can still pay you to work on something on behalf of the state after you've terminated what was that public officer position. That's one of the exceptions. And you can also get a public interest waiver, though they're subject to the approval of the commissioner and the attorney general. There's a one-year bar on lobbying, so if you fit within this, I'll be looking at number six, a member of the State Board or Commission, potentially there, then you've got a one-year bar on lobbying after your state service, with some exceptions for volunteer lobbying and representational lobbying, subject to those statutes outside of the Ethics Act, but cross-referenced. Moving on to the next. Misuse of information. So this applies to current and former public officers. That's the purpose of the slide being there, but we already talked about that. That it doesn't stop, you know, the obligation not to use confidential information even after the 2 years. This is the improper influence in state contracts, grants, leases, or loans. This is the AS 3952-150. So the Ethics Act prohibits you and members of your immediate family from receiving certain state grants, contracts, leases, and loans. And you can have immediate family members or yourself apply for things unless if you may take or withhold official action affecting the award, then that's prohibited or affecting the execution or administration of that grant, contract, lease, or loan. So that's when it's implicated. We can go on to the next. There are some exceptions. For competitively solicited grants, contracts, leases, and loans, you can be involved in those as a public officer unless you work for the administrative unit awarding the grant, contract, or lease. Then that's strictly barred, or you work for the administrative unit for which the grant, contract, or lease is awarded, or you take actual official action that affects it. And in loans, is also within the same statute but a different subsection. You and your immediate family member may have interest in a loan that's generally available to members of the public and subject to fixed eligibility standards. As long as you don't step over the line and actually take official action that's affecting it. So suppose your daughter wants to apply for a grant from your agency and your normal duties include serving on a committee that awards those grants. May she apply? No, unless the grant is competitively solicited and you take no official action with respect to the award or administration of the grant, or your designated ethics supervisor determines that your committee duties can be reassigned.
So, hold on. So Randy, a relative of a board member, direct family member, makes an application to ADA for a loan. And it's, we'll say first it's under $3 million. So if it's under $3 million, if it's loan participation program, which it goes to a bank first, and then ADA takes a portion of that, would that be considered a conflict?
Chair, I think what we would do in that situation is at least issue spot it, flag it, and then confirm that it is or isn't through Matt's office with an opinion would be a way we could do it. But I think, Matt, it's going to, unless you're aware one way or the other for sure right now, the better approach is to...
Under $3 million, it is over $3 million, right? That's why I said $3 million first.
Right.
So we have nothing to do with it in the $3 million approval process. That's separate loan finance committee. Over $3 million, it comes to the board, which obviously that would be a conflict.
Right.
I mean, you have to declare the conflict and not vote on it or something.
Correct.
You can't preclude the person from doing business with Ada, the third party, can you? We can't say, you know, your uncle is applying for a loan for a commercial piece of property, and because his nephew's on the board or niece on the Ada board, he can't apply. But that doesn't make sense, does it?
Right. So, Chair,
in that situation, the obligation is not on the outside person. The obligation is on the public officer. In some situations, the public officer might have to resign potentially if somebody is insisting on participating and they can't. But that's something we want to look at the circumstances, because that's also pretty extreme stuff.
Did you say resign or recuse?
It depends on which part of AS 3952-150 is being addressed. Because there are certain conflicts that can be reassigned more in terms of the loans. There are certain ones that can't be cured specifically under that statute. It's a stronger statute than the ordinary misuse of official position. So, again, that's a pretty big step, so we want to look at the circumstances.
So, Matt, I think what the chair and maybe the members are saying is they would never have received notice that there even was an application.
Yeah.
So they would have no notice of an issue.
That's all taken into consideration. There's a pretty wide set of potential sanctions under the Ethics Act, and sometimes it's a pretty wide scope. So it's not everything's going to be the ultimate thing.
It's a small state.
Yeah.
Well, again, it's you know, the borrower is going to their bank. The bank has options where to go with if they want to put the loan with another entity, part of the loan. It's part of the loan. It's not 100%. It takes up to 90% of the loan, depending on what the loan people think, the committees of risk and all that. So I'm just trying to understand that. What I want to get away from is, but if a board member doesn't know there's a loan going through, he would never know, and then all of a sudden there's criticism because he didn't know.
Right. So,
you know, and people have different names, so, you know.
That's right.
You know, if Bill Kendrick's got an uncle named, you know, Bill Kellogg, you know what I mean, or an aunt or something that's married to it.
Right.
You know, if their name, he would never know unless they physically called him up and said, you know, Northrim Bank is asking Ada to take a position with a loan with Northrim.
Right.
He just never know.
But I think, Chair, what you're getting at is almost a due process notice issue of how can I be held responsible when I had no
yeah.
notice.
Yeah.
You know, so it
that doesn't,
it's all taken in. It would definitely be taken into consideration. That's part of the point of things being really context specific.
Okay.
So how long do you take for you to think
Under the statute, we have 60 days to return it. In practice, we do it faster than that, just depending on what the workflow is like. Mm-hmm. How many other requests?
That'd be tough on a loan application. Yeah, you'd have to help them.
We'll be left on time. Okay. What also comes up under misuse of official position is the restriction on using state funds, resources for partisan political purposes. So that would be for activities intended to benefit a candidate or a potential candidate or a political party or group. The most clear ones usually are like candidate, potential candidate. Those are usually pretty identifiable people. Political party, very identifiable. Political group, there's a little bit of nuance there, and sometimes we consider APOC statutes it's good to ask about. That's just something that's just to be aware of, that the definition goes that broad, and just ask for advice. And anybody other than governor, lieutenant governor, because those ones are recognized as political positions, you need to take approved leave for political activities if it's going to, I mean, you guys are board members, it's a little bit different, but for like public employees, if it's going to interfere with normal work hours or work functions, you need to take pre-approved leave. And there is a limitation where some political purposes are okay if the intent is to benefit the public interest at large through the normal performance of official duties. So really easy examples of that would be somebody who's a public officer participating in the March Against Domestic Violence or Denim Day. You would look at that and you'd say, like, this has a political element, but this is also such a, like, a broad, that it's going to be rare to find a person protesting against it. Let's look at it another way. But in general, state resources shouldn't be used for political stuff. And this has come up a few times, but the questions are Randy and us back and forth with the Section 240 and stuff. The Ethics Act, it has all of these ways that it can be violated, right? So those are the sword elements, but there's also the shield element, where in a lot of ways the Ethics Act relies on people communicating and getting advice and disclosing things. So it can be a sword, but it can also be a shield to protect you. So if you seek advice with full disclosure of the facts, follow that advice, you're protected by that, coming from our office. And part of the function of that is that we're also the office that does the intake for ethics complaints. And anybody can submit an ethics complaint, can be a member of the public, whoever. It just has to be in writing, signed under oath, which typically means notarized, and contain a clear statement of facts so we can evaluate whether or not there's probable cause that a violation occurred. If it's not properly completed or there's not probable cause, then we end up dismissing it with notice to the public officer of the complaint and the dismissal. If it does pass through that initial part, then it goes into further investigation and can be processed initially before the personnel board, depending on if it goes, you know, continues to go that at the end of the investigation. And in some cases, there's ways to appeal also to the, you know, superior court and so on. But generally, particularly in the investigatory phase, that's all confidential until something public is served on someone. So if you have an ethics complaint, let's say, that says, board member did, you know, X, Y, Z, and then we look at it and then we say, oh, we already issued an opinion, the board member told us the relevant facts, and we said it was okay for them to do X, Y, Z. Complaint is dismissed now with notice to them, and it's confidential. The person who submitted the complaint is not allowed to disclose that they submitted it. So, thanks. Yeah. So, mentioned that basically, but reach out to the designated ethics supervisor for most things, for like formal requests for advisory opinions. That's how it's set up in the statute. But also, you can shoot me an email with questions if you want to, matthew.stinson@alaska.gov. I've got a phone number at the end of the slide. But it is best if we're working with and looping in with the DES. But just the important part is reaching out and asking for advice. Getting out ahead of things is very helpful because we just don't want the act violated. Yeah. I think that, yeah, so I'd be the chair. The chair is the ethics supervisor. But, yeah, you can communicate with Randy or with Kent, and I communicate with them on questions and stuff, too. So, yeah, the important part is just recognizing issue spotting and reaching out. And so for situations, as long as it's not that the AS 39-52-150 thing, because that's more strict, that's the general misuse of official position concerns. There's a process for the board to vote and deliberate on those things. Obviously, it's the members of the board also that are the experts on what the board actually does, and there's acknowledgement of that. So if somebody has what they think is a potential conflict, and they declare it on public record and have something in writing for both the designated ethics supervisor and the attorney general to see, generally that writing requirement is going to be met if it's just, if it's something that's recorded, you know, accessible. We'll go to the next slide. Okay. And so the basic process is somebody declares that they had a conflict, then the chair says, okay, this conflict is substantial and you should abstain, or the chair says, no, this conflict is insubstantial. If anybody who's on the board disagrees with the chair, they can speak up and say, no, we need a vote on this. And then the group as a whole votes, the chair also votes, the group as a whole votes, and the majority rule wins out basically on the member can or can't participate in this particular thing. If the member complies with the vote of the board, then they're safe under the Ethics Act as long as our office didn't issue an advisory opinion saying that it's not allowable. So if our office has said that it's allowable, the board can decide and vote amongst themselves and say, no, this person can't. But if we have said that it isn't allowable, the board can't vote and say, no, go ahead. That's how it works. Yep.
So your opinion is post-decision by the board?
Yeah. Well, if the board member reaches out with something in writing for our review, yeah, I mean, in practice, there's times when we're assessing something after the fact. And, all the stuff's considered along with it. Just sometimes there's going to be a need for correcting, and we might publish an opinion and so on. So, yeah.
So is it in statute that Department of Law's position opinion has to be followed?
Yeah.
It's in statute.
That's in statute, yeah. There's I'm almost certain that it is. I'll say that there's a regulation that overlaps that lists a lot of the details, and then there's the statute. But I'll double check. I have this kind of combined in the slides.
Not right really, but I don't think we'd be trying to circumvent that. But you never know down the line. So
I say you're getting all the way down to accepting, and then we get an opinion back. AG's office says no, I'll stop.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, typically, opinions are good. It's an opinion, right? Which is really advice. So I'm trying to figure out if this is the rule, law, or is this an opinion? That's why I asked that question.
And then the opinion has the role also in the statute in terms of shielding from liability if it's being complied with, if there's a complaint and the person's in front of the personnel board.
Yeah. Well, the state's been shielding it. They can still bring suits or do whatever. The person making the complaint.
The person making the complaint can, there's different things that they can do. They can file an objection within a certain time frame. Then the personnel board can make a recommendation for something to be taken up. But there's a few different things that can go there.
I think time goes pretty fast for us. Yeah. Okay.
And I've covered this, yeah. All right, so this is a specific conflict of interest statute that applies. So a member of the authority may not vote on a resolution of the authority relating to a lease or contract to be entered into by the authority under this chapter if the member is a party to the lease or contract, or has a direct ownership or equity interest in a firm, partnership, corporation, or association that may be a party to the contract or lease. A resolution of the authority is approved by the majority of the members who are not barred from voting under this is valid if the is a valid action of the authority for all purposes. So this is specific to the individual. You notice it doesn't include like an immediate family member. The Ethics Act does though, and still applies. But this is specific conflict of interest statute that predated the Ethics Act that was not overruled by the Ethics Act specifically, so they both exist and run concurrently. So this is another statute to be aware of if somebody has a direct ownership or equity interest, either themselves or, firm, partnership, corporation, association, and a contract release, and they can't participate in the voting board.
Is this part of the legislators?
Legislators have a different Ethics Act.
That's a big surprise.
Well, what I see is, someone will, over the years, someone will stand up and say, I have a conflict, and then the Senate President of the Speaker will go without objection, and then if someone objects, then they force them to vote on it.
Hmm.
And there's no debate. So I'm just curious. It's a little bit different than here.
It is different. It is different. So covered this. These are the requirements for a complaint, writing under oath, pre-statement. So this is a little bit about the procedure. Wait, I think go back real quick. All right, yeah, forward a little bit right there. Okay, so if it's the complaints against the governor, lieutenant governor, AG, those go to the personnel board directly, and it's an outside independent counsel that assesses them. for all other public officers, they go to the Attorney General's office, and we review those, and then I talked about the process for dismissal or going forward a little bit. So we, yeah. And it's confidential. Unless the person in the complaint agrees to make the complaint public, or the Attorney General initiates formal proceedings by serving an accusation on the person named in the complaint. And, yeah, the reminder, if you seek full advice, disclosure of the facts, all that advice is protected. And we can probably just skip that, I think. If you're worried that you're speaking on something political, you should disclaim and say you're speaking in your personal capacity, not as a member of the board, so on. And don't use state equipment for political purposes, or state funds, or state time for those things, unless you're the governor or lieutenant governor. And avoid spent partisan political material at work. Don't try and require people to contribute to campaigns. And with some exception under the regulation for political specific appointments, don't inquire about your staff's political affiliation and so on. All right, and if you need to reach out, my email is just my name, just with the full Matthew. So if you're feeling mad about something I said, it's perfect there. Full Matthew.Stinson@alaska.gov. That's the contact. That's also, if you just Google Alaska Executive Branch Ethics Act or State Ethics Act, you can get to our landing page that has a lot of like frequently asked questions. And then my contact information is right at the top there as well. So easy to find. So the chair for the board, for ADA staff, the designated ethics supervisor is Randy. The chair is the designated ethics supervisor for the board. And, but, you know, feel free to reach out to Randy and we communicate. He sends requests for advice and so on to our office. And that's my paralegal, particularly if you have a question about reporting requirements, like quarterly reporting requirements. She's the best person to talk to about those. So, all right.
Great, thank you,
Matt. Yeah. Thanks for having me. And again, you know, that's the beginning, not the end. Feel free to reach out for advice as it comes up. Go from my office down there.
Okay. Brings us up to new business, and I'll read it in its entirety, Ken. Executive session, confidential public matters related to personnel, financing, LESKM project, legislative matters, ADIS financing, budget projects, all which are subject to deliberative process of privilege, other matters related to ADA, which are subject to specific legal advice and our attorney-client privilege. So, I will look for a motion to go into executive session.
This is Bill Kendrick. I move that the board enter an executive session for the purpose of discussing the following matters related to personnel, financing for LESM project, matters related to ADA's finances, budgets, and projects, other matters related to ADA that are subject to specific legal advice, which is subject to the attorney-client privilege and communications. These matters, which if discussed publicly, could have an adverse effect on the finances of ADA and are matters that attorney-client privilege and matters involving consideration of government records that by law are not subject to public disclosure due to the executive or deliberative process, privilege, or other law. The executive session and matters discussed therein are proper subjects for an executive session under the Alaska Open Meetings Act, reference Alaska Statute 44-62-310C, 1, 3, and 4, and the Alaska Public Records Act.
This is Albert. I'll second.
All right. The objection was Ramey Polhor.
Commissioner Sandy?
Yes.
Commissioner Crum?
Yes.
Mr. Fogel?
Yes.
Mr. Ellich?
Yes.
Mr. Kendi?
Yes.
Mr. Beaglemore?
Yes.
Chair Cruz?
Yes.
Sir.
All right. Who's the image?
Back on the record.
Thank you. Well, we'll come out of executive session, and I will advise that the public that the board did not take any actions on the matters discussed while in executive session. The session is limited to discussions of matters directly protected from the public disclosures of the Open Meeting Act. All right, back to our agenda this morning. We are going on a new business, item B, resolution G24-04, LES Chem. And Randy?
Thank you, Chair. So, for the Chair and the Board, we're now on 7D, which is a resolution authorizing ADA to loan up to $70 million to finance construction and operation of a petrochemical plant on the North Slope, specifically a plant operated by LES Chem, which would produce ultra-low sulfur diesel and methanol. Methanol is currently shipped in, I believe, from Trinidad.
Sorry. Methanol is currently shipped in from Trinidad and has to be shipped and then trucked all the way to the slope, so there's significant emission savings as well from the project. The project meets our statutory mission of economic development and jobs under 4488-010-100. It also qualifies as a development finance project under AS 4488-172 and the definition of a development project in 4488-900. The resolution would authorize myself to complete the financing package and execute the documents necessary to move forward with the project. The terms of the loan include several preconditions that, unless met, we would not go forward. So the agency authority is protected in that regard. I would urge the members to approve the resolution.
Thank you. Questions? Randy, before we go to entertain the motion on the resolution? All right. Well, I'll say, Randy, I appreciate the efforts for your staff putting into this. I know it's been months and stuff. I think it's my personal opinion, it's a great project. And as all the earmarks of being successful, but we all know there's risk involved in everything. And aid is not a business that's risk. You know, we have to take risks. That's our charter, our mission is, there's risk involved. And so, but this looks like, from my perspective, it takes providing the methanol needed on our slow, it takes a lot of trucks off the road. I think it'll help DOT maintenance. I think it also takes a lot of trucks off the road and provide, low sulfur diesel, which is a plus. So I think it'll help the environment. It certainly will help risk of the environment for trucks on the road having a problem, maybe going in the ditch and spills and happen. So I appreciate that.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to specifically thank Mr. Johns for the many hours he put into it. I spent only part of that time with him, but Mr. Johns put really hard work effort into the due diligence and several other staff.
I would like to, if this resolution passes, and that's a if, I would like to request that we get updates often. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in board session, just notes or something to the board members. And if there is a groundbreaking ceremony, that we are afforded the availability to see it. Okay?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
All right, I'll entertain a motion for G24-04.
This is Bill Kennedy. I move resolution G24-04, resolution of the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority approving a development project financing loan under Alaska Statute 44-88-172 to LES Chem LLC to finance the construction of long-term operations of a chemical plant on the North Slope of Alaska.
This is Albert. I'll second.
Thank you. Discussion? For ADA, this is a large loan, I think for all of our reasons. I think, though, in the last 10 years, prices have gone up quite a bit. So relatively, it's not a large loan when you consider inflation and the cost of doing business.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just think hopefully this is a continued trend of us in Alaska continuing to make solutions for Alaskans and not utilizing resources in the lower 48 or outside of our country. This is what we should be aiming for, is to put Alaskans to work and mining our own resources here.
I will also say that there's I appreciate Jeff's and Randy, everybody else associated with this. There is an absolute great benefit with a long-term benefit to the residents of Alaska after the loan's paid off. And I think that, generational. And I think that's a great thing. And I think we should stress that a little bit in our public awareness, that they see that it's not just a loan, but it's long-term, there's long-term dividends to ADA in the state.
Yeah.
And it's a win-win for everybody.
In more than one way.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair.
Adam?
Yeah, I just appreciate the fact that this is a great opportunity set for ADA. This makes every mission an aspect of our charter for opportunity in Alaska, but also opportunity for Alaska jobs, the long-term aspect, the scalability of it. And on top of that, it's a homegrown project that's actually developed by Alaskans. Primary investors are Alaskans, the primary developer is Alaskan. It's a pretty exciting prospect when we look at what we can do in our state together, and glad to be a part of it. Really appreciate the long due diligence that ADA staff put into this to make sure that it met all the metrics and the risk profile. So thank you, Randy and team.
Well said, Adam. Thank you. Further discussion. Randy, would you poll the board?
Commissioner Sandy?
Yes.
Commissioner Crum?
Yes.
Mr. Fogel?
Yes.
Mr. Ellich?
Yes.
Mr. Kendi?
Yes.
Mr. Beavermore?
Yes.
Chair Cruz?
Yes.
The motion passed.
Thank you. All right. That brings us up to Director's comments. Andrew?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some project updates for the Chair and the Board. I'll be fairly brief. West Sioux project, ADA's industrial road at the access for West Sioux. Field season is contracted for. It'll be starting up soon. I believe there's even an event scheduled for early June in Squetna that we'll get information out to the board members on if they want to attend. That project is underway. We anticipate filing for a core permit in the fall, and at the same time we file under the new NEPA rules, we can actually submit a draft version of the NEPA for a decision. We think that'll shorten the decision time down to a year. So we think we can be fully permitted in a year and ready to move pretty quickly. Ambler project, I think the chair and members are aware of the recent action by MANA to state that their bornite mine, they would not like to advance that at this moment. That's up to them. It's on their property. The project will still continue. There's 600,000 acres of state mining claims that are out there, and a lot of those claims aren't anywhere near NANA land, so we'll respect their decision and avoid NANA land and move forward with the project. The Alyeskan project, you're all aware of. FedEx lease will be hopefully wrapped up in the next week or two. We've negotiated a rate that's significantly higher than the previous rate. That'll be on the June agenda. We've also been digging into, Mr. Chair, the shipyard, and we anticipate having some information and recommendations for the board and members on the shipyard. Was down there 2 weeks ago walking the yard and talking to folks, and we have some other reports, appraisal, and some other information that's come in. So we'll be diving pretty deep into the shipyard at the next meeting.
When is the current leaseor or leasee, when is that?
There's a break I believe, in fall of 25, where we have an opportunity to make a change if we want to make a change, or we can accept an offer or an option to extend them for another 10 years. So we'll be getting into that pretty heavy at the next meeting, Chair. That's it for the project updates. Item 8B, the loan dashboard reports in members' packets. We've put $14 million on the street so far in the fiscal year. That's not including the Alaska Hotel Group loan, which is another $25 million. That's going to bump us up to, I believe, pretty close to the low 40s for the year, which is a pretty good year for LPP, and got some other promising projects in the pipeline. So we'll keep working with Tiffany's out on personal leave right now, but she'll be back, and we'll sit down with her. And
you got a fairly robust pipeline?
I believe we do have some other significant projects in the pipeline coming, but they take a lot of work, as you know. It's very thorough due diligence. So,
have you had an opportunity to address the cost of funds?
Cost of funds is underway, and we're hoping to get that set for the June meeting as well. Yeah. Interior energy reports of the legislature, Mr. Chair, is in members' packets. The standard statistical summary for the small business rural development loan programs is in members' packets, and that's comments for today.
Questions on that? All right, so it's showing that our next meeting is scheduled for June 20th. Board comments.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead,
Randy, just thank you again for all the hard work and going pretty much all over the state, especially down to Juneau, and handling to make sure that our budget was not taken elsewhere, which would have had detrimental effects. And you've really built a great staff, and you should be proud of what you've done here. It's been an amazing turnaround this past year, so thank you.
Thank you.
What's amazing to me, Randy, is that we had the opportunity to ask a lot of questions, and without fail, staff or you have everything ready for us. It's just very refreshing to work with such a professional group.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Randy, do we see a T&L or anything on IGU?
Chair, I haven't. I know we get some information. I haven't seen it.
We need to see that. It's attached with the interior budget.
Sure.
That.
Absolutely.
And then how it compares to their original performa when we made the loans. Okay. So we can track that.
Look at the historic.
Yes.
We'll do that.
Further questions or comments? Julie or Adam?
No, nothing from me. Thank you.
Okay. I'm good, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill or Bill?
I just echo what everybody else says, Randy, that you do an excellent job. You got an excellent staff. Your professionalism trickles down to them, and it shows.
Thank you.
Well, I know it's 4 o'clock. I was at the office before the meeting, and I'm going to be at my office after the meeting today. So I appreciate Ada's staff and putting together a nice meeting today. Long executive session, but we got through a lot. And some exciting opportunities on the horizon for us. And, I'd like to make sure that the public, the legislature, and administration are all aware of that, and what we're doing to make a difference in our state, and just the actual positive things that it is doing. So that'll be a discussion on how to execute that
next meeting, and we'll discuss it then. So with that, I'll take a motion.